This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Yaakov runs away from Lavan, and Lavan pursues him and catches up with him and accuses him, among other things, of stealing his gold. Yaakov explains why he did it, and on the accusation of having stolen Lavan's gold, he says, "Im asher timtso es Elohecho lo yichye." With whom you will find your idol that it's been hidden, search, and if you find your idol, that person will not live. Says the Ibn Ezra, "Rak ehergen." I'll kill that person. Or, says the Ibn Ezra, "Yeshimim sheyodeh tfilo." I pray for their death. So to convince Lavan that he has nothing to do with it, he says, I curse anybody who has your idol, that they should not live. Says Rashi, "Umei oiso kelolo, meiso rochel baderech." And as a result of that curse, Rochel never got home. She was the one who had stolen the trophy. She is the one who had stolen the idol, or taken the idol, and she dies before she gets home. More amazing even than that is what the Baal HaTurim brings at the beginning of Vayechi, where Yaakov, we're told, lived for a shorter time than his father. 33 years less than his father. V'chayo lamed gimel shono pochos mi oviv. And Yaakov lived for 33 years less than his father. Bishum dichtiv, because it says, kilas chinom loy tovoy. A pasuk in Mishle, an unnecessary curse will come back to him. Rashi and Mishle learn that means it will come back to he who issued the curse. Al shekilel Rochel, by virtue of him having cursed Rochel, for Omar, and he said, "Im asher timtso es Elohecho lo yichye." With he whom you find your idols, that person shall not live. Chosru loy minyan yichye. So the numeric value of the word yichye, which is 33, is deducted from Yaakov's life. Shehu lamed gimel mishnayso, which is 33 years of his life. Terrible consequences for a statement that is allowed to be issued because of something he couldn't possibly have known. Yaakov has taught his family the importance of gezel absolutely to the last meticulous detail. And Chazal tell us it's normal that you'll find if a family lives together, these are after all daughters of Lavan, living in Lavan's household for 20 years. And for most of that time it was in the same house, they didn't even have a separate area. It's inevitable, says Chazal, that two daughters-in-law living in a house for 20 years, aren't you going to find the teaspoon gets mixed up, a pair of socks gets mixed up, a knife and fork gets mixed up, a plate gets mixed up. After 20 years, surely you'll find something of Lavan's in Yaakov's household. Says Yaakov, you can search through and see if you find anything. You won't find a pin that comes from your household, Lavan. So absolutely confident is he that it's not possible that anybody took something deliberately. It's not possible even that there's anything there by mistake. They must have gone through it over and over, day after day, and made sure that there's nothing that there was that wasn't theirs. So careful were they on any chashash of theft, on any possibility of reaching a shemitz even of stealing something which belongs to Lavan. And so Yaakov, in absolute confidence, says, "One thing I'm for sure, nobody walked into your house and took out your idols. You won't even find a pin in our house that is yours. What do you think, you're going to find an idol? What would we want with the thing?" And so he feels quite free to issue the statement to convince you, Lavan, anybody you find that will die, search, there's absolutely no question that it's here. For that he loses 33 years of his life. And for that Rochel dies before she gets to Eretz Yisrael. Why? Why is a man punished for something which is beyond his ability? could he have known? So the answer is yes, the person is not punished for Ones. Ones Rachmana Patzer. If a person did something which is beyond his control, he's Patzer, he doesn't get punished for it. Yaakov is punished, which means it was not beyond his control. That it was somehow within his control to be able to foresee that. How come? That's such a statement he should have made. He should have thought of the possibility. As distant as the possibility is, there should be enough concern for Rachel and Leah just in case. It's highly unlikely. There isn't even a pin, there isn't a... So what chance is there that they would have stolen? But who knows? There's a slight chance. It's a 1 in a million chance. But for that 1 in a million, and it must have been only a 1 in a million chance, because if it was any more than that, Yaakov would never have said such a terrible thing. It's not Yaakov's style to make statements like this. Anybody with whom you find this will not live. How can he make such a statement unless he's almost 100% sure? He must have been almost 100% sure that it couldn't be in his house. But he's punished, which means that he wasn't 100%. He was only 99.99% recurring sure that it wasn't in his house, and that's not enough to issue such a statement. He should have been concerned for the distant possibility that somebody in his household did take the items. And for that he loses 33 years. Which 33 years? Not 33 years of his childhood. 33 years of his peak. 33 of his last years, of his years of greatest achievement. 33 years of his reunification with Yosef are taken away from him. After he comes back to Mitzrayim and at last his life's ambition, the family are united, and for the first time in the history of that family, the Shalom Bayis. The brothers are getting on well together. Yosef is prime minister in Mitzrayim. He has COVID. He's living in a good way. 33 of those years are removed from him because he let such a thing pass his lips. That's the danger of, on their level, if we would do such a thing, I'm sure we wouldn't be punished for it because we wouldn't be expected to be that sensitive. But the reason that we wouldn't be punished is not because it's not serious. The reason it wouldn't be punished is just because the revolution doesn't expect it of us. It's to our discredit, not to our credit, that we wouldn't be punished for such things. If we would be punished for such things, we wouldn't survive. 33 years would be taken off the first time, another 33 years the second time, another 33 years the third time. How many years would we have left to live? There would be nothing left of our lives. We can't operate on that level of refinement. But that doesn't mean that it's not serious. The seriousness of the action we see from the way Yaakov is punished for it. That's what the measure of seriousness is. The way we're punished is not a measure of seriousness. We're not punished because we can't take the punishment, not because we didn't commit a serious crime. If you want to measure the seriousness of the crime, that you'll measure by the way Yaakov is punished. And Yaakov is punished with 33 years of the best part of his life removed. For what? For saying something which didn't take consideration of a terribly distant possibility. Somebody could be damaged. Somebody in his family could be harmed by the statement. It's almost impossible. But it's almost impossible. And that almost is enough to take care of. If that's how serious it is to ignore a distant possibility, can you imagine how seriously the Ribbono Shel Olam judges lack of caring closer by? When one should be expected to notice. Where one should be expected to see that somebody's miserable, that somebody's hurt, that somebody's could be damaged by something you're about to do or about to say. If Yaakov is punished for something he virtually could not have foreseen, can you imagine what is required of us in terms of caring for one another in areas where it can be foreseen? With a little bit of thought, with a little bit of sensitivity, with a little bit of depth and a little bit of effort. It's unbelievable. The standards of caring which are required. And the tremendous power of the Ribbono Shel Olam's din against us when chas v'sholom we ignore the possibility of causing damage to another human being. For a distant possibility, this is severe punishment. For an obvious possibility, how much more so? This caring, it's a matter of noticing, that's all. And what I want to talk to you about this evening is that it is in the area of noticing that the greatest progress can be made, It's in the area of not noticing that the greatest damage occurs, and that it's in the area of noticing, of being observant, that one's greatest contributions and one's most powerful originality can be expressed. We're not talking about people who are deliberately malicious. Something else that's plotted and schemed and deliberate, that's not what we're talking about. Most of the hurt, most of the damage which we cause one another is caused plain and simply, we didn't realize the consequences of an action. We did something without fully appreciating the extent of the consequences. What about the other way around? Noticing things that need to be done. In the beginning of the parasha, we're told that Yaakov left Be'er Sheva and he went to Choron. Vayifka b'mokum, he struck the place, vayolen shom, and he slept over there, kivo ha-shemesh, because the sun set. Chazal pointed out that that's a strange way of wording it. You don't sleep somewhere because the sun sets. You travel the sun sets and you drop, so there and there, you put your bags down and sleep. You plan a little bit, you know what time of the day it is, you know how many hours there is still for the day before it gets dark, you know where your next town is, and you plan where you're going to stop for the night. You don't travel until the sun sets, and as the sun goes down, you lie down and take a stone and go to sleep. So Chazal said, Kivo HaShemesh, Hoyolei Lichtoi Vayovo HaShemesh Vayolein Shem. It should have said, the sun sets, and he dwelt there, he slept there. Kivo HaShemesh, what does it mean? He slept there because the sun set. Mashma, it implies, Sheshoko Loi Chamo Pitoim, the sun set suddenly. Not at the right time. Kedei sheyolin sham, the Ribbono Shel Olam wanted him to sleep there. It wasn't that the sun set, so he slept. He had to sleep there, so the sun set very much too early. He was going along the way, planning that he could get to a particular place to sleep, and all of a sudden it got dark, so he had to stop there and sleep. Why is that? So Chazal tell us, this tzaddik comes to my home, to my hotel. You think I'm going to let him go on without resting him a little bit? Okay, this was the Beis HaMikdash, this was Yerushalayim. The Ribbono Shel Olam didn't like the idea that he was just passing through, so he makes the sun set in order to require that he settles down. But if you look at the geography, all this doesn't work out, says Rashi. Omer Rabbi Loza b'shem Rabbi Yossi ben Zimri. Hasulam hazeh, this ladder which Yaakov dreamt about, its base was in Be'er Sheva. The emtza shipuoi magia k'neged Beis HaMikdash, and the middle of its slant was opposite the Beis HaMikdash. Shebe'er Sheva oimed bidroi moshel Yehuda, because Be'er Sheva is at the south of Yehuda. Yerushalayim b'tzvoino, and Yerushalayim is at the north of Yehuda, b'gvul shebein Yehuda v'nyomim, just at the borderline between Yehuda and Binyomin. Uveisel oyo b'tzofen shel nachlas Binyomin, and Beisel was north of Binyomin, b'gvul shebein Binyomin uvein b'nei Yosef, just at the borderline of Binyomin and Yosef. So you've got Yehuda, Binyomin, Yosef, going from north, from south to north. Be'er Sheva was at the southernmost border of Yehuda. Yerushalayim is in between Binyamin and Yehuda, that's the middle, and Beisel is at the northern point of Binyamin. Nimtzo, it emerges, Sulam Shiraglov b'Be'er Sheva, a ladder whose feet would be at Be'er Sheva, Veroshua b'Beisel, and its head would be at Beit El. It's not 100% clear today where Beit El is. There is a settlement called Beit El, and they feel they're very confident that it's... But that's where Beit El is. The Machlokes Rashi and Ramban has emerged as to precisely where it was. But Rashi tells us it was on the border of Yehuda and Yosef. Then Magia Emtza Shipuyo Neged Yerushalayim, the middle of its slant would be opposite Yerushalayim. I don't know whether that means geometrically so, that Yerushalayim was equidistant to Be'er Sheva and to Beit El, or whether it means simply diagrammatically so, since you had southernmost border was Yehuda, of Yehuda was Be'er Sheva. Then there was the border of Yehuda and Binyamin was Yerushalayim, and the top of Binyamin was Beit El. So if you just divided it into three lines, the bottom of Yehuda, the border between Yehuda and Binyamin, and the top of Binyamin, and made them equal, just for geographic, just from a diagrammatic representation, then it would emerge that if the ladder had its feet at Be'er Sheva and it had its top at Beit El, the middle would be in Yerushalayim.
This tzaddik comes to my hotel. Is he going to go on without sleeping? And further they said, Yaakov called Yerushalayim Beit El.
But where Yaakov was sleeping was Luz. It wasn't Yerushalayim. So what's going on here?
So where do they connect them?
I say, Shnei Kar HaRamoria Uvalekai. He actually slept in Beit El, and that's where he had his dream. And Har Amoria, the mount on which the Beis Hamikdash is, actually moved to meet him in Beit El. V'zuhi kvitzas ha'oretz ha'amuru b'shchitas chulin. And this is the kvitzas ha'oretz, the removal of the earth, which the Gemara discusses. Shebo Beis Hamikdash likrosoi ad Beit El. The Beis Hamikdash came to meet Yaakov up to Beit El.
We don't understand in today's terminology exactly what that means. That there were continental movements, and that there, in that part of the world particularly, there seems to have been a lot going on geologically at various different times.
Maybe actually there was a movement, and that the place of the Beis Hamikdash actually did change. Difficult to know whether this has to be taken absolutely literally or exactly how it works, but what we see is that he went to sleep in Beis El, and that point of Beis El at that moment had the combined Kedusha of Beis El and the Beis HaMikdash. It was as if he was standing on both places simultaneously.
And that's what it means, he hit the place. What does it mean, he hit the place? He was coming to Beis El, and Yerushalayim was coming towards him, and they hit. At Beit El, it was the accident.
The Imtema. Now, Rashi asks an amazing question. Let's plot the course of Yaakov. Now that we've worked out the geography, we can work out the course of Yaakov. He started in Be'er Sheva, and he went to Beit El. Rashi tells us that if there's a ladder with its feet in Be'er Sheva and its head in Beit El, the middle will cross over Yerushalayim. That means that if you draw a line from Beit El, from not a vertical or diagonal line, but if you draw a flat line from Be'er Sheva to Beit El, it must pass through Yerushalayim. So Yaakov walked past Yerushalayim to Beit El. If the Ribbono Shel Olam made the sun set so suddenly that he should sleep, why did he have to make the sun set at Beit El and then bring the Beis HaMikdash to Beit El? Wouldn't it have been easier to make the sunset when he walked past the Beis HaMikdash? Bin Torah Ruchashe Over Yaakov al Beis HaMikdash, when Yaakov walked past the Beis HaMikdash, Madua Lu Ikvo Sham, why didn't the Ribbono Shel Olam keep him there?
Answers Rashi. He who lo yoyid libe li spalo b'mokim shi spalo l'avisov.
He didn't think of davening in the place where his fathers had davened.
Umin HaShemayim Yagvu, do you think from heaven they're going to make him stop there?
So Rashi's telling us, God's not going to keep him in Yerushalayim. If he doesn't want to dive in Yerushalayim, let him go.
But we just learned that God did stop him in Beit El.
So also says Rashi, that's not so simple.
Ihu ad Choron Ozal, he went all the way to Choron, to Mesopotamia.
Because that's what it says in the beginning, Kedam Rinan.
Vayelech Choron.
It says right at the beginning, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva. Yaakov went out of Be'er Sheva. Vayelech Choron.
Literally it means, and he went towards Choron.
Says Rashi, that means he went to Choron, he went all the way to Choron.
And later it says, Vayivka b'mochim v'yol en sham, he hit the place and he slept there.
But the place that he hit is long before you get to Choron, it's Beisel.
Says Rashi, he got to Choron, he got to Mesopotamia.
Kimato l'Choron, when he reached Choron,
Omar, he said, Eksha shavalti amochim shispadlu avisa v'le ispalalti bo?
Is it possible that I crossed a place where my fathers, where my forefathers had davened, and I didn't stop to daven there. It suddenly struck him. When he worked out his route, he figured that he must have crossed the very places where Avram had davened, where his father Yitzchak had davened, and he didn't stop. He didn't find those places to stop and to daven there also. Yoavdate, he applied his mind, Lemahadah, to return. V'chozar, and he returned, Ad Beisel. Now he's coming from north to south. When he reached Beisel, that's where the Ribbono Shel Olam stopped him. And there the Beis HaMikdash came to meet him. Didn't want to trouble him to go any further than Beisel. He was after all coming back from a long trip. And at Beisel, the Ribbono Shel Olam brings the Beis HaMikdash to meet him. Now the whole thing begins to make sense. If he were going on his first way around, then he should have been stopped at the Beis HaMikdash, but he didn't. He wasn't stopped at all. It was he who thought of the idea to stop there. But he thought too late. He was already in Haran. So he turns around and he reverses all the way back as far as Beisel. At that point, Bayifka, Bamokim, the sun suddenly he sets and he lies down and he finds himself not only in Beisel, but also on Haramuriya. At the same time, he finds himself on the Mokim Beis HaMikdash. And what happens there? Firstly, this is the origin of the whole Beis HaMikdash. If Yaakov did not step there that evening, who knows whether the Beis HaMikdash would ever have been built? And there Hashem speaks to him and says, Ani Hashem Elokei Avraham Avicha, etc. Ha'aretz asher atah shoicheh aleiha lecha et benu lezarecha. He gives him Eretz Yisrael. V'hoyo zar'acho ke'afar ha'aretz, and your seed will be like the dust of the land. V'forotz lo yom ha'vekeid ma'vetzafein ha'vanegba, and you shall spread out east and west, east and north and south. V'nivruchu b'chol kol mishpachos Yisrael adomu lezarecha, and all the nations of the earth will be blessed through you and your children. And I shall be with you. Look at that wonderful bracha he gets. Ushmar ticho, and I shall guard you. Bechol asher telech, wherever you go. V'hashivu sich ve'adam azis, and I shall bring you back to this place. Ki lo ye'ezovcho, I shall not leave you. Ad asher imasisi, as asher dibati loch, until I have done what I've told you. Listen to this bracha. His whole future is given to him in this dream that he has in this place in Beisel. And he nearly missed it. Not he nearly missed it, he did miss it. This whole thing would never have occurred if he didn't think of going back when he got to Choron. The Ribbono Shel Olam was prepared to let him walk right over the Beis HaMikdash without saying to him, Yaakov, stop a moment, come in and daven. I remember when I was a very little boy, and my father had long leave, and we went over to England. The first Shabbos there was going to be the treat of our lives, because my father's style of work and lifestyle was such that his busiest day was Monday, but Tuesday was a little bit busier than Monday, and Wednesday was a little bit busier than Tuesday, and Thursday was a little bit busier than Wednesday, and Friday was a bit busier than Thursday, and Shabbos was the busiest of all except for Sunday. And this was the first time that we were going to be on holiday with him. Because to have long leave, he used to have to save up his leave. And in those days, to go overseas, it took a long time. There was a big schlep, people didn't do it very often. You didn't go for a month or two if we went, and he wanted us to be in school there, and in yeshivas there. So he used to want to go for 4 or 5 months. So he'd saved up 4 or 5 years. I was 7 years old when we went, which means we didn't have a holiday from the time I was 2 or 3. And the first Shabbos we were going to be there was going to be a Mechayah. Because we were going to go to the early Minyan. A Minyan which finished at about 8:30, I suppose. We were used to Johannesburg, where Shul finished at 11. And then he used to give 2 shiurim afterwards, from 11 to 12 and from 12 to 1. And then we used to come home and have a rather hurried lunch, because he used to have to start preparing his evening shiurim. So we didn't see him at all. So this 8:30, we were going to be finished davening, and there were no shiurim. He didn't have to prepare shiurim. We didn't have to get the shiurim. The whole Shabbos free. We had been looking forward to this for many months already. From the time my parents told us we were going overseas, we started looking forward to that first Shabbos. And I remember on the ship on the way there, we used to walk round and round on the deck, and we used to talk about what we were going to do with 8:30 that Shabbos. How he's going to take us for a walk in Golders Green Park. And we used to open the maps, and we used to see where the shul was and where Golders Green Park was, and we used to plot exactly how we were going to get there, and we were going to walk through, and it was going to be a Mechayah. And my mother would go to the late minyan, which would be a mechaya for her as well. While we were going for a walk in the park, she could go to the late minyan, and by the time we got back, it still wouldn't be so late, and we could have kiddush together and lunch together. It was something we were just waiting for. And we go to shul early in the morning, and we daven, and everything's lovely. 8:30, we're out of there, and we're on for our walk. We haven't walked more than 50 yards, and a yid comes out, shouts at my father, "Atenta for a minyan, atenta, atenta, we did a minyan." What could you do? My father pretended he wasn't Jewish. It didn't help. Eventually, they schlepped him in. I've davened already. They didn't want to know. He's a tenter for a minyan, and they pulled him in. And he just whispered to us on the way in, he said, "Make as much noise as you want to hear until they throw us out." We weren't trained in making noise, so we weren't too successful. And they were trained in making noise, so they didn't even notice us making the noise. And they didn't throw us out. That was the end of our Shabbos. Let somebody come and call Yaakov Avinu as he walks past the Beis HaMikdash and say, "Atenta, daven here, you're walking past the shul, stop and daven." No. Gets him walk right past Yerushalayim, right past Beisel, to walk over the very spot where Avram had davened, where Yitzchok had davened, to walk over the spot where his father was nearly brought as a korban, to walk over Haramuria. Not to think. Ribbono Shlom is not interested in pointing out to him, arousing his curiosity. Nothing. You want to walk? Walk. And what would have happened? No Beis HaMikdash. No promise, all these promises of the Ribbono Shlom, guarding him and keeping him and bringing him back, and for us the Yama became with the point of an egg bone, that your children will be cured for all it. All these promises which form the basis of Klal Yisrael in the future would have been lost. Had Yaakov not thought when he got back to Choron, "I better go back. I've walked over the very spot where my parents have davened, and I didn't stop there." And the Loshon that the Chazal used, which Rashi quotes, is Yohiv Daite. Yohiv Yad Daite Lumihada. He applied his mind to returning. That required thought, that required analysis. It wasn't just, "Let's go back." He applied his mind, "I need to return," and off he goes back, all the way back. The power of observation. The first time he walks past and he doesn't observe, and he goes and nothing happens. Then he observes and the whole future, the whole history of the Jewish people changes, because a little thought entered Yaakov's mind. And hadn't that thought entered Yaakov's mind, it would have been gone, finished, fulfilled. Moshe Rabbeinu tending to the sheep of Yisrael, and he sees a bush burning. No big voices coming from the bush. Nobody calling him, "Moshe, Moshe." How does the Ribbono Shloim attract his attention? The bush burns and remains green. Will he notice? If he'll notice, then the whole thing starts. And he notices. The bush is burning and it doesn't get consumed, and he goes to investigate. Curiosity, plain and simple, natural, scientific curiosity. Moshe is amazed by a scientific phenomenon which he doesn't understand. What does he say? I'm busy learning. Who cares? So let the bush burn. I'm busy learning. I've got to go and investigate bushes. No. A bush is burnt, unnatural, something peculiar is happening. What is it? He realizes there's a Ribbono Shel Olam here. These things don't happen if there isn't a Ribbono Shel Olam. If it's just natural and nobody wants the attention to be taken, the bush would burn. Let's see what's happening. What does he do? He goes and he investigates. And at that point, he's charged with a mission of bringing Bnei Yisrael out of Mitzrayim. And if he wouldn't have, what would have happened? Moshe should have noticed the bush burning. If he'd have noticed the bush burning, he wouldn't have noticed that the leaves stayed green. Had his mind on other things. Can you imagine what Moshe Rabbeinu was thinking at that time? Can you imagine where his mind was at that time? Couldn't he be excused for not noticing a scientific phenomenon? Had he not noticed that, we could still have been in Mitzrayim today. Who knows what would have been? No, Moshe Rabbeinu, the giving of the Torah, no coming into Eretz Yisrael. Who knows what would have happened? But Ribbono Shel Olam, call him at least. Call him. Can you imagine Kibiyochel, so to say, that Ribbono Shel Olam's heart beating as Moshe walks past? Is he going to notice or isn't he going to notice? The whole future of the world depends on whether an old man with his mind in Torah tending the sheep of Yisrael is going to notice that a bush is not being consumed by fire, or whether he's not going to notice it. That's all. On that hangs the whole future of the human race, never mind the Jewish people. Moshe notices. And there it all goes well. The power of observation. What the Ribbono Shel Olam is prepared to allow to go past unattended to, if we don't notice, there's no limit to it. He is prepared to allow everything to change. He's prepared to allow everything to go to nothing if we won't notice. That's one thing he's not going to do for us. To give us curiosity, that he won't give. You've either got it or you don't have it. You don't have the curiosity, then you deserve to lie and stagnate where you are, and you won't change and the world won't change, and just carry on the way you are. Curiosity is something that Ribbono Shel Olam won't give us. And curiosity is the aleph beis, it's the absolute bottom of any kind of achievement, of any kind of progress, not only in Torah, but in life altogether. In the Zohar, there are two phrases which are used very frequently, the Isaruso de l'Elo and the Isaruso del Tato. Isaruso de l'Elo is the awakening from above. Sometimes the Ribbono Shel Olam brings his presence to be felt from above. Whether we like it or not, we feel it. And sometimes there needs to be an Isaruso de l'Tato. We need to stir things up from the bottom. And if we don't stir them up from the bottom, they don't get stirred up at all. We have to do it down here. The Isarusa del Pato is curiosity. Just the ability to notice something's out of place, something's peculiar, something's strange, something's magnificent, and to go and investigate, to do something about it. That's all. If there is that kind of consciousness, if there is that kind of alertness, that awareness, what can result from it? A promise to Yaakov Avinu. The dream of the ladder. The ultimate binyan beis hamikdash. All that from just thinking. Where have I walked? I've walked across the very place where my parents davened, and I didn't stop there. Let me go back. Let me go and experience that of standing in that very place. That's what I need to feel. That curiosity, that desire, that wandering spirit that desires to understand these things, establishes the future of Klal Yisrael. And Moshe Rabbeinu, who goes to investigate a burning bush, that sets the path of Yetzias Mitzrayim in motion. It applies in everything. We've often talked about appreciating things. Last night we talked again. It's not possible to appreciate if one isn't curious. One can only appreciate the most gross of things if one isn't curious. To appreciate the subtleties of life, one needs to be very curious. And it applies absolutely everywhere. One can read a book. Does one really appreciate the brilliance of it? One doesn't. Here and there you see something which happens to, with an Isarusa de l'Elo. It's so powerful, it comes from above, it hits you like a ton of bricks. So it wakes you up and you say, oh, that's brilliant. But the little subtleties, the choice of words, where the author sat with his pencil and crossed out one word and replaced it with another, not crossed that word out and replaced it with another until he chose the word which was just right, and we just read over it. We don't notice. Why not? That middle of curiosity is not there. The Isarusa del Tator, just to put ourselves in his place and to understand why that choice of word, how clever. How accurate, how brilliant to think of that phrase to use. That's the godless. But we don't stop to think. We don't care. We're just listening to the Isarusa de l'Elo. We're prepared to have our ears open for God to speak to us, or for other people to speak to us, in a way which is so gross that unless we fall asleep, we'll hear it. But the Isarusa de l'Tato, that kind of listening, which requires an ear, which requires understanding, which requires alertness, that we've forgotten altogether. We don't know how to listen. We don't know how to hear. We don't know how to read. Listen to a piece of music. What's the difference between a Mozart symphony and Barbara Black Sheep? What's the difference? To most people, there's no difference. People say Mozart's better, so they listen to Mozart. It's a little bit more, it's less monotonous. They don't know why it's less monotonous, so they listen to Mozart. More instruments play. What's the difference, really? Why do you listen to this rather than to Baba Black Sheep?
The embassy is that if one would listen terribly carefully, one would find that in every note there lies brilliance. The choice of the note is, it's a note when one understands, I wouldn't have been able to choose that note. No matter how musical I was, no matter how much I knew, if I was writing, I wouldn't have done it that way. It's goyness, it's brilliant, it's absolutely outstanding. I would have missed it. That kind of curiosity to note that within the musical structure, he's chosen a phrase which, it's like the bush that burns and the fire and the leaves remain green. It's unusual, it's unbelievable, it's not the kind of thing one would normally do. As one's reading through some prose or some poetry, to notice a phrase which is so brilliant, one wouldn't have thought of doing it that way, and it's so right after it's done. But I wouldn't have done it. That's what one needs to be able to understand. In interpersonal relationships, one needs it. To have one's eyes open, one's ears open. Yaakov. To think of the possibility that Rachel has got the trophy, a distant possibility. But when you're 100% alert, even distant possibilities one has to keep one's eyes open for. Is it possible that what I'm going to say is going to damage somebody in a way which I don't intend the damage to be? If I intend it to damage, that's a different discussion. But is it possible that in some way or other it's going to damage somebody? Who thinks that meticulously? Who exercises that kind of care? You're not used to it. We speak with the same kind of carelessness with which we listen. We listen assuming that the person who's speaking is an idiot, and we speak assuming that the people who are listening are idiots. And so the whole level of our interpersonal relationships drop down to levels of coarseness and insensitivity. And that's not right. In the Beis HaMikdash, that's perhaps the most important element of all. Vayemir HaMelech El Nosan HaNovi. King David said to Nosan HaNovi in Shmuel Beis Perek Zayin. He says, look, Anochi Yoshev Beves Arozim, I'm sitting in a paneled home of cedarwood, Vareno Elohim Yoshev Beseich HaYeviyah, and the Ark of the Ribbono Shelom is sitting in a tent. It's not right. Observation. He's noticed an inconsistency. He's noticed something which needs correction. He's noticed something which is wrong. Is there an Isaruso de Laila? Has anything been told to him? Has he been instructed to build a Beis HaMikdash? No, it doesn't say anywhere in the Torah you shall build a Beis HaMikdash. You have to build a Mishkan, and the Mishkan has to be brought out of the Yerushalayim, which is done already. Nowhere does it say he has to do anything more than that. He notices something which is discordant. He notices a lack of harmony. He feels there's something wrong. Look at my house, and look at the Ribbono Shel'olam's house. He doesn't even say what he wants to do about it, and Nosson says to him, Kol Asher Bilvovcha Leicha, say, whatever's in your heart, go and do, because Hashem is with you. The observation is good, you're correct, do what you want to correct it. That night, the Ribbono Shel Olam comes to Nosan HaNovi and tells him, tell David not to build the Beis HaMikdash. And there are different reasons as to why not David HaMelech. There's a Medrash that David HaMelech was too powerful, the Beis HaMikdash would have been indestructible had David HaMelech built it. There's the Ramban who says that because of the killing which he had to do, there was too much din and too little rachamim in David's personality, and therefore it wasn't correct, it wasn't quite the right person to build the Beis HaMikdash. Be that as it may, who built it? Shlomo. And why does Shlomo build it? Because David is the one who thought of it, and Hashem says, David, wonderful, but you can't do it, the next one will do it, your child will do it. And had David not thought of it, who would have built it? Nobody. Had David not thought of it, and Shlomo wouldn't have thought of it, and the next king wouldn't have thought of it, there would have never been a Beis HaMikdash. We're beginning to find that the greatest events of Jewish history took place as a result of somebody thinking of it. And had they not thought of it, it wouldn't have taken place. The great result, the great concepts and the great events in Jewish history were not as a result of Isarusa Delailah. The Yetzias Mitzrayim was not because the Ribbono Shelam said, Moshe, come, let's go, take them out. The Yetzias Mitzrayim was because Moshe noticed a bush that was burning and wasn't being destroyed. The Beis HaMikdash was built initially on Yerushalayim because Yaakov Avinu thought that he wanted to daven in a place where his parents had davened. Had Yaakov not thought of that, there would have been no Yerushalayim. The ultimate Beis HaMikdash was built because David HaMelech wakes up one morning in his beautiful home and he says, pass me that I am in this house and the Ribbono Shel Olam's Oren is in the Yiriyot, it's in a tent. It's not right.
It's not because they looked in the Shulchan Aruch. It's not because they looked at the Torah and they saw there was a particular mitzvah or a particular deal. This is their own personal contribution to the future of Yiddishkeit. They created it. The Beis HaMikdash was created by David HaMelech. Yerushalayim was created by Yaakov. Yetzias Mitzrayim was created by Moshe. All these great things created by individuals who happen to be curious. Individuals who happen to be alert and awake and stimulated and ready to notice and sensitive. Ribbono Shel Olam in fact comments, Hatova dibarti machat shifte Yisrael asher tzivisi lilus es amiyas Yisrael leimor lama lo ibinisim libeis arozim? Have I ever complained to any of the leaders of Yisrael, why haven't you built me a palace, a Beis HaMikdash? I never asked for it. And as a result of that, he says, Ve'eye imcho. What does he give David that night? I shall be with you in everything you do. Ve'achriso es kolo yevecho miponecho. Listen to what he gives him. I shall destroy all your enemies from before you. Ve'asisu l'cho shem godol, and I shall make a great name for you. K'shem ha'gdolim asher b'aretz, like the greatest in the world. And I'll make a place for Yisrael, and they'll dwell there securely. And they will no longer be disturbed. Bad people will not continue to afflict them, as in the past. When your days are filled, and you lie with your fathers, you die. Your seed that comes after you will succeed you. He gives eternity to David HaMelech. The eternity of the reign of David HaMelech comes that night. And I shall prepare his kingdom. He will build the Beis HaMikdash. And I shall prepare his kingdom forever. That's already the foundations of Mashiach are being laid that night. That there will always be a descendant of David HaMelech at the throne. Why? Who elicited that promise out of the Ribbono Shel Olam? Who stimulated that promise to come, this unbelievable promise, which again affects the future of Bnei Israel right throughout its history? What did it? One statement of David HaMelech. Ra'eino anoichi yoshev beveis aron, arozim, v'arino elikim yoshev v'soich ha'yiriyah. Look, Nosson, he says. Isn't this strange? Look at my palace, how beautiful. And look at the Mishkan, it's a little tent. That statement changes the history of Klal Yisrael. That statement gives a Beis HaMikdash. That statement gives an eternal throne to the family of David HaMelech. That statement gives us Mashiach Tzidkenu. The observation, just the noticing of how odd it looks. That's all. The greatest events in history are created by people noticing. Just noticing things that are odd. Noticing things that need attention. Noticing things that need further investigation. What we have here is a very exciting and a very frightening concept. We have to even right in the very beginning with Avraham Avinu. How did Yiddishkeit start? The Medrash says in the beginning of Lech Lecha, Amar Rabbi Yitzchok, Mashal le'echod shehoya oiver mimokum lemokum. Like a person who was traveling around, biro achas lekes, and he saw a beautiful mansion on fire. Omar, he said, Tomer shabira azu bli naniv. Is this building does not have an owner? The concept here is, if I remember, I was traveling, I think I mentioned before that for students, maybe even today, but certainly when I was in yeshiva, one could get all sorts of wonderful airway deals where you could travel for very little money from one place to another if you were prepared to go all sorts of cockeyed routes, which we were only too delighted to do at the time. And once I found a way of getting from Eretz Israel to England for the wedding of my cousin and getting back to Eretz Israel, it was about £15, about 30 rand. But I had to go via Istanbul and via Paris and via all sorts of exciting places, which was fine. And on the way back, put us in an old cockeyed aeroplane, and while waiting to take off, the ticket was a very, very frightening ticket to read. I was reading the small print, and it basically said, we don't undertake to get you anywhere, basically. they seemed to undertake to get us off the ground, but there was quite... What's going on here? And I couldn't speak the language. I go to all the authorities, they say, which plane did you come off? I said, well, that plane over there, because it didn't even have a name on it. It was a plane with British Airways colours, and it didn't even have a name on it. I said, from that plane there, they said, that plane, that's not our responsibility. We don't know anything about it. I said, who does? Well, ask so-and-so. Go over there, please. I said, I came off that aeroplane. That aeroplane, we know nothing about. And went around. Nobody knew anything about this aeroplane. It felt as if I'd been dreaming, as if I'd walked off some non-existent aeroplane for which nobody would take responsibility. Eventually, I tried to find the most senior person that I could see around there, and I said, look, I want to know something. If I get into that aeroplane there, and I drive it off, who's going to come running after me? Oh, I said, that fellow there, he's the one who will come running after you. It's his aeroplane. No, then one could establish. Avraham Avinu is living in a world which is going down the drain. Generation by generation it's deteriorating. It's had a mabul. It's had a flood. It's had a Dor HaFlogo. It's had the Tower of Babel. The place is deteriorating and deteriorating, and nobody seems to care. It goes on. Says the Medrash, it's like a person who sees a house on fire and nobody's doing anything. Nobody's called the fire brigade, nobody's throwing water over it, nothing. That's the time you can see who the balabos is. As long as the house is going fine, you don't know who the balabos is. It's overseas somewhere. When the house is on fire, that's the time to see who's the balabos. Hates it all of balabiro. Yeah, then somebody says, yeah, I'm the balabos. It suits me that it's on fire. I'm going to collect a nice insurance for it. Don't worry. Goodbye. Keep your nose out of it. But the initial assumption is when you see a house on fire and nobody's doing anything, there's no balabos. Can it be that this world has no balabos? It's deteriorating, it's being destroyed, and nobody's calling the fire brigade, nobody's doing anything about it. Picked up from behind the curtain of Omele, and he said, I'm the balabos. It's all right. I know what's happening, don't worry. It's deliberate. And that's the way Avraham Avinu discovers the Ribbono Shel Olam. By noticing a deteriorating world and no balabos. As long as the world goes well, one can be excused for not noticing the Ribbono Shel Olam. It looks as if the world has been set on clockwork and the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to take a nap. So you can be excused for not thinking that there's a balabos. You know, people nowadays it's become very fashionable to have battery watches. And they're very accurate. But there's a particular watch designer in Switzerland who's just made the statement. He says, can you imagine today if they invented the clockwork or clock? A watch that doesn't even need a battery. Can you imagine how excited the world would be? Just because the clockwork one came first and now the battery work, well, everybody's excited to watch it, you don't even have to wind. And what about an automatic clockwork one that doesn't need a battery and you don't have to wind it? Surely that's the ultimate of technological ability. One notices the balabos, or it's one's dependence on the balabos, when something goes wrong. You've got a quartz watch, you don't have to wind it, you don't have to do anything, you forget about it, it's just magic, it always tells the right time. All of a sudden it stops. You're going to take it to somebody to take a little thing out of the back and put one back in. And you realize that all you've got is a piece of tin which needs a battery to make it work. When you see the olam going like clockwork and everything happens, the sun rises in the morning and it sets in the evening and everything's beautiful, one forgets that it has a battery, one forgets that it has a Ribbono Shel Olam. But when you see the world is beginning to stop, it's going slower and slower and slower, and nobody's doing anything. That's the time, if there's curiosity, that the Ribbono Shel Olam can be discovered. That's when Avraham Avinu discovered the Ribbono Shel Olam. He said, oi, what's happening here? This is like a bush that's burning up, and nobody's doing anything. It's a building that's burning up, and nobody's doing anything. That was enough for the Ribbono Shel Olam to say, here I am. And before that, why didn't the Ribbono Shel Olam say, here I am? Avraham Avinu was looking for the Ribbono Shel Olam, searching, but he didn't find the point at which to discover it. Something has to come from him first. There's got to be an amazement. There's got to be an expression of curiosity before the Ribbono Shel Olam will come out of his hiding place. The Ribbono Shel Olam will not reveal himself unless we've gone searching, and not only gone searching, unless we are amazed at his absence. Then he'll say, here I am. So So the founding of Yiddishkeit was an act of curiosity. The establishment of Yerushalayim was an act of curiosity. The establishment of the Beis Hamikdash was an act of curiosity. The future of the Malchus Beis David, the throne of the House of David, resulting ultimately in the Mashiach, is an act of curiosity. That's the area where we need to excel. When it comes to Is Arusa de Le'ilo, when it comes to motivation from on top, there is no place for individuality. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, do, you do. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, keep the Shabbos, we all keep the Shabbos. The Ribbono Shel Olam says, keep Kashrus, we all keep Kashrus. We all do these things in more or less the same way. Where is the possibility for an individual to make a contribution? In his power of observation. Just he'ora, just to notice. Just to notice things that other people wouldn't. Because each individual's power of observation is different. Every individual notices something else. No two people look at the same situation and see the same peculiarities. They see the same basic form, but not the same peculiarities. You take two artists both painting the same vase of flowers. It's the same basic form, you've got the same outline there. But the peculiarities with which each one notes, the curiosity of each artist as expressed in his work, is going to be different. One will notice the color as being peculiar, as being strange. One will notice the texture. One will notice the relationship of the vase of flowers to its background. Each one will pick on something else which will amaze him, which will impress his artistic sensitivity. No two people are going to notice the same thing. When we say the same chalkeinu b'seir osecha, give our part in your Torah. Each individual has the power to notice things in the Torah which other people wouldn't notice. You can't make up new pieces of Torah. You can't add to the Torah. So what's my contribution? My contribution is to notice things that nobody else has noticed. To notice inconsistencies, to notice imbalances, to notice peculiarities. Because behind every peculiarity is a balabos. Within a framework of consistency, when a peculiarity is expressed, that's where you have the genius. If you hear the noise of piano keys, somebody banging on the piano, you don't have to listen for peculiarities. Because there's no genius behind the whole thing. The whole thing is chaotic. But if you hear music which is following a very, very set formula, a very, very classical form it's following, step by step, and when you listen carefully, you notice within that classical form there are oddments. There are things which are strange. There are things which are ingenious. Oh, you know there's a balabos. You know there's some magnificent composer behind it. If you look at the world and everything's going fine, you won't notice anything. If you notice here and there little inconsistencies, you'll notice the balabos. The husband who comes into his home, and every morning when he comes back from shul, breakfast is ready. And when he comes back from work, supper is ready, and the children are bathed and ready. And the house is neat and tidy, and the next day the same thing, and the next day the same thing. And his wife begins to wonder why he doesn't appreciate him. It's unnatural to be appreciated when everything runs with clockwork efficiency. What's there to appreciate? It's like the watch, so with the battery. Skip supper out one day and you'll see all of a sudden what will happen. Let him come home from work one day, where's supper? Supper? What's supper? What do you mean, what's supper? Oh, now we're ready. Now there's a relationship between husband and wife already. Now there's some communication. You realize it's not clockwork, there's a balabos. Or a peculiarity. If you really want to get him, prepare him cereal and eggs for supper. Let him come back and say, this is breakfast. This is what's going on here? Peculiarity. Okay, there's a balabos. And when there is a peculiarity, when the wife buys something special for the home, prepares a special meal for the home, rearranges the furniture, cleans the curtains, and he doesn't notice, that's serious, because then there's no curiosity. Then she has actually, within the classical form, has expressed herself, and he hasn't picked it up, he hasn't noticed at all. Then you've got something which is very serious. In Yerushalayim, when we were in Yeshiva, we did an experiment one snowy morning to see whether we were very disturbed that a lot of the Yeshiva people weren't observant enough. Not observant in the sense that they didn't observe Yiddishkeit, but observant in the sense that they didn't observe life. And we tried to see to what extent what you had to do to make a person notice that something was wrong. How far did you have to go? So we stood on our balcony and we started making snowballs and we started dropping them. But I had a roommate whose aim was absolutely meticulous within millimeters. And he would start dropping them around the person. So clockwise, one in front of him and then just around, Poshet missing him by a millimeter. To figure out, is the person going to at least look up? And figure out, where are these things coming, the most, the miracle that they, each one misses me? Maybe the Ribbono Shel Olam, maybe there's an angel doing it, what is it? Do you know that nobody looked up? They took it absolutely for granted, didn't notice that anything was peculiar. Snowing, so snowballs are falling off the trees. I'm not one hits me. Each one misses me by the same distance and goes clockwork around me as I walk down the road. Okay, doesn't notice. That's sick. That there is no possibility for progress if one's eyes are so closed. And if one's power of observation is so stifled. It's not possible to achieve anything at all. First thing is a need for curiosity, a need for sensitivity, a need for awareness, a need to notice that within the normal run of things, things are happening which are abnormal. And I have good or bad news for you, that when you'll open your eyes, you'll be surprised at how much abnormality there is. And you'll be surprised at how little there is that is normal altogether. If you'll start noticing your wives and your husbands, if you start noticing your parents and your children, if you start noticing your friends and your chavruses and your colleagues, if you start reading the newspaper, if you start listening to the news, if you start watching people in the street, you will be amazed at how the whole world is abnormal. And the richness of experience that this opens to one, if one will only notice, each one has his own way of noticing what one can see, what one can understand in people. Just to work out what would have been predictable, and in what way a person has reacted in an unpredictable way, then you know there's something which you haven't understood. When you listen to a phrase of music and you predict the next note and you're wrong, he gives another note, you know there's something you haven't understood, you know there's a genius behind it. When you predict a person's next act and he acts differently, you know there's something you're missing. Something needs further investigation, something needs attention. When you see that a person isn't behaving according to his normal style, you know something's wrong. He's overexcited, or he's sad, he's depressed, something. That one has to be able to pick up, that one has to be able to notice, and to that one has to be able to respond. Going into a period of holiday, on the one hand one is relieved of responsibility to a degree, and one of the distractions of the power of observation is this responsibility. One has one's mind on all sorts of other things, and everybody's got their minds on their own little problems, and so they miss the wonderful world going past them. And you can throw snowballs around them and they won't notice it. One because he's got his mind on a Tosfos, and another one because he's got a mind on his bank overdraft. Each one for their own reasons would miss the burning bush, and would miss going back to David in Beisel, and would miss building a Beis HaMikdash. All these things which will not be done if we don't take that first step. All these great things which the Ribbono Shel Olam is only waiting. Somebody should notice and I'll do it. He wants it, I'll do it. Let him just notice that it needs to be done. All these things we're prepared to miss because we're distracted by the pressures of our own lives. That's very tragic. But comes the holiday time when one's relieved of those pressures, it's a good time to start practicing. It's a good time to start opening one's eyes, opening one's ears, listening for inconsistencies. Remember somebody who had a big factory told me, it's not just with them, it's with everybody who's good at their work. He says, I can walk into my factory and I can listen, and I'll stop for a moment, and I'll immediately hear if there's something wrong in the whole factory. And I didn't believe him, and he took me and he showed me. Walked in, listened, and made a beeline to a particular machine, and he realized something was wrong. So tuned is his ear to how the factory should sound, that's all he needs. If I know how the factory should sound, the moment there's a deviation from that, I know there's something wrong. I know how my wife should sound, the moment there's a deviation from that, I know there's something wrong. I know how my husband should sound, I know how my friend should sound. Once you know what the norm is, what it should sound like when it's healthy, one's able to pick up immediately. An accountant is able to look at the balance sheet and put his finger up. There's something wrong. He knows exactly what it's supposed to look like, and he can pick out immediately when there's a deviation. That's a professional, that's somebody who knows his business. A computer programmer can look through these pages and pages of gobbledygook, that's where it is. Because he knows what it's supposed to look like. Somebody who doesn't know what it's supposed to look like can look over and over and over again, and he won't pick it out. Our ear needs to be finely tuned to the normal, so that the moment there's a deviation from the normal, we'll notice, we'll respond, we'll be aware of it. And with that, if one is able to develop that, the sensitivity that results, the eye-opening that results, the increased response to one another that results, is something which enriches not only one's own life, but the lives of everybody into whose contact one comes.